You're listening to BQN. Assimilate the audio.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of All Good Things, the Star Trek Universe podcast here on BQN and the Fandom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark White, and with me today are Christos and Calvin. Hey, guys.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
So far, so good. Where is Amy? What happened? What did you guys do with Amy?
Boys club today.
Yeah, it's Amy's turn. She took the escape pod, so.
She did. Oh, at the very last minute, too. We heard from her about an hour and a half ago, and she's just like, oh, whoops, I'm not going to be there.
It is Easter Sunday here, so, you know, I think she had some plans that she forgot about.
Yeah, she had to go hide some eggs.
Dear, you've made that sound weirdly
gynecological. Oh, Lord. I wasn't even thinking
gross,
that.
Gross, gross, gross.
No. My gay ears. I don't want to think about that part of the anatomy.
Human females. Oh.
Well, guys, do we have any feedback or anything? No?
I'll give you feedback because I wasn't on last week.
Okay.
I actually really liked it, and I don't know how I would have been on last week because it was already an hour and 20-minute episode. And if we would have taken on my choices, it would have been a two-hour episode. But well done. It was very, I think when we had talked about the idea of the episode, it was going to be one of those, could we fill up an episode talking about this? And you guys had no problems at all.
It's kind of famous last words whenever we say that. They tend to be the longest episodes.
Right?
And I will say, we'll talk about Picard and Crusher at some later date. Actually, probably want to have the resolution of how season 3 of Picard ends to be able to really be able to, you know, intelligently encapsulate their relationship. So stay tuned for a later date.
Well, Christos, do you have any tea you want to spill on any Star Trek stuff happening this week?
Not so much happening this week. Well, I mean, this particular week was, it was First Contact Day. And man, what a dud First Contact Day was this year. I mean, we got some really fun rainbow-esque super gay character posters for Strange New World Season 2. But that's all we got. I think everybody was like expecting some big Section 31 or Star Trek Legacy or even these maybe mini-series trailers, movies that they've alluded to.
Yeah.
But, man, we got nothing. I think we've gotten spoiled the last couple of First Contact days. What do you guys think?
I think it's weird that they released the news about the Academy series a few days before, and there was a couple of little bits. So why not just save them for actual First Contact Day? It would have been, I mean, who's doing
it? It was
marketing
all a week before, even the renewal of A Strange New Worlds and the renewal of Lower Decks. You could have just held on to that for like a week and at least, you know.
Would have generated some buzz.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm really thinking this is all because Picard has such buzz right now and it continues to be so talked about that they just do not want to drop a trailer or anything that's going to potentially distract. And that's why I think it's another reason why I think they put it a little bit ahead. June 15th, we're going to have almost a 2-month gap again in Trek. So, and I'm cool with that, but I think they just really want to say, okay, Picard's going to have its ending and we're going to talk that out and then we'll start marketing Strange New Worlds, you know, in mass. So,
you've just depressed me now. I didn't realize we had a 2-month gap with no new Star Trek. That's going to be quite painful.
You know what?
Isn't
sometimes
it?
It's okay. Like, I feel like, you know, when we were getting like, what, we had over 50 episodes last year, and we're going to have 40 this year, which is a lot. There's other things to watch. So a little time out is not a bad thing.
And it does mean we can use Twitter on a Thursday without fear of spoilers,
I suppose.
It means
I don't have to get out of bed at 5 a.m. on Thursday to watch Star Trek so that I don't have to get spoiled. And honestly, I just want to know. So like, I'm that curious to know what's next that it's worth getting up. The other thing that came out this week was the new remastered 4K editions of the Next Generation movies. Those dropped the day before First Contact Day. You can get those individually or in a box set. I have had the opportunity to watch Nemesis and First Contact, and I can tell you, First Contact is beautiful. Nemesis, it looks really good. It looks much better than any version we've had so far, but I don't know what, they didn't get it to look as nice as First Contact. I don't understand how that could be, given that it was made 5 or 6 years later, but it still looks good. It sounds amazing. I was kind of jarred a few times with the surround sound watching it last night.
A lot of these things are on discount right now on iTunes, so worth checking out.
Piece. Yeah, whole seasons, whole series, not just seasons of Trek shows are on sale, including TOS, which we're going to be talking about today.
Well, before we launch into that, though, I think it's time for...
This is the bridge! All hands to emergency escape pods!
Escape pod!
All hands, abandon ship!
I'm assuming you guys probably watched this recent episode of Star Trek Picard and wasn't like, nah, maybe I'll get to
I
it.
Think,
no, you guys probably
I think
watched
the correct
it.
Question, Mark, is how many times have you watched it?
So, thoughts?
Yeah, I loved it. As we said last week, and as it was hinted online, it did feel like almost a two-parter within the 10-part series. It very much followed on from episode 7 with the whole kind of Vadicon on the Titan. Another great episode. I'm a little... I can't decide if I'm annoyed or happy about the whole... the way we don't yet know what the deal is with Jack. It's episode 9, you know, the penultimate episode this coming week, and there's still mystery going on. You know, the final episode should just be the big battle and the resolution. And, you know, it's almost, if you think of a TNG episode with the Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, Act 4, you kind of know what the mystery of the week is in Act 2. So it's modern storytelling, and it's great for the speculation, and it's obviously it's why we talk about it here on the show. But yeah, the kind of the basic thirsty gay in me just wants to know what's going on.
Yeah. It's like you've been fapping for 9 weeks and no release.
Well, I think that I have a feeling that it's going to all pay off. I feel like they're kind of building up to like, well, I feel like they keep on like, they think they have it figured out and then it's this and then it's that and then... So I'm more certain than ever that I think it's Borg. I don't know if you saw the scene from next week's episode that kind of is a continuation on of where it left off. It shows Troy opening the door and she like flips out and runs. I think she saw the Borg. Because, I mean, what she's not going to see the paw race and freak out. She probably wouldn't even know what it is. Unless it was just this overwhelming feeling that she got. I think it's, oh, shit, it's the Borg. And she runs out and she's going to run her way all the way to the bridge to go say, red alert. I don't know. That's my thought. So, overall, the episode, I got to say, even when I rewatched it, I kind of almost fast-forwarded through the first 20, 25 minutes. It is some really, really dark storytelling with the execution of the crew and just how dire things get. It's some really dark Star Trek, and I'm not just meaning the lighting. It's really dark. For me, the episode really starts to feel good, kind of starting from, you know, when Worf comes in and puts his little new, whatever his new knife is, through the changeling, and things start to, the tide starts to turn. I don't know that I appreciated how dark the end of episode 7 and how dark the first part of episode 8 are. And I almost want to say it's too dark. But I do love the part from there on. I just, there's so many satisfying things that come. Mark, what are your thoughts?
Episode 7, first of all, to me, it was as though that episode, Stardust City Rag, was only the torture scene. To me, that episode 7 was just complete darkness without much levity at all. There was nothing to balance it out, right? And so we get into episode 8, and yes, the beginning part of it is dark, similar to like Stardust City Rag, but then there's that whole other half that brings it up and gives the balance. And so I was great with episode 8 because even though, like you said, and I agree with you, the beginning part is very dark, they at least switch it up, I think, around the midway point to make it lighter and more optimistic. And you're like, okay, like, they're going to win the day. Because of that balance, I can appreciate the whole episode in its entirety of being like a really one of my favorites of the whole season. It was just, I like that balance. So I was really appreciative of that.
I mean, they killed Tavine. How could they?
Yeah, but how many lines did she have anyway?
But when you talk about the idea of this potentially being the start of a spinoff show, The Next Generation, Next Generation, one thing that I almost said Titan, is that Picard has done so well, is introduce us to the bridge crew of the Titan. And I mean, a lot more than just LaForge, you know. I feel like I'm kind of invested with the Bajoran guy and Tavine and all of them. And so, I mean, it made me feel something
what
more.
What was Tavine's role?
She's a science officer.
Because now there's an open spot. I mean, we could have even Raffi come on and take over whatever that role is or what
she's
have
not
you.
She's not the science officer.
I don't think she'd be a very good science officer.
No, she's a security man.
There is an open spot there. So
but,
to bring somebody else on.
I don't know. Is, you know, Vulcan, Delton, whatever she was, some sort of hybrid. I thought she could have been a very interesting character. I wanted to see more.
Kill the girl with the tattoos or whatever. Yeah.
They could have killed her.
Or the girl with the green
hair. Yeah, I would have rather them killed her.
No.
I just think at least if anyone's going to die, I'd rather it be one of the new characters than one of the legacy characters. So
we're all in agreement there.
I was fine. but they did a really good job of making us feel invested in these junior officers, this crew. And I know we're not here to kind of slag off Discovery, but just kind of to make that point of difference. What we've said about the kind of the bridge crew on Discovery, who we don't know much backstory, we don't really know them as individuals. Mm-hmm. Picard has done such a better job in just 8 episodes that when they did kill Tavine, it actually meant something. Yeah. It was a kind of, you know, scream at the TV moment. So yeah.
Discovery was the only one that I feel like didn't get that, because even Strange New Worlds, you have the secondary, like, bridge officers and stuff. And in that first season, like, we know who a lot of the crew is there as well. And Prodigy and Lower Decks.
Yeah. One thing I completely hadn't thought about was when Shaw confronts Seven and says, why didn't you blow the turbolift out of the ship? Which I guess is something you can do, right? Jettison the turbolift. And that would have killed Shaw, but also prevented Vadic from getting on the bridge. That was interesting. Something I hadn't even thought of as being a possibility in the moment.
It's good that they put that dialogue in there, because it's fans like us that would, you know, if we knew that was a feature, like, why didn't they do this? That's such a plot hole. So they're almost acknowledging it, so we don't have to whinge about it. However, plot hole, they changed sex of Spot again. So Spot, the cat, has gone from being male to female.
It's just
all
how he identifies, or she identifies. She's trans. You know, so one thing I've been thinking about, and we got 2 episodes, so I want to say this now so we can see if it's remedied. You know, looking back, we're 8 episodes in, 80% through it. You know, when I look back at Crusher in episode 1 and episode 2, and, you know, why did she hide Jack? And I think because it seems like it's gotten back to business as normal so much that it really makes her decision to hide Jack for 20 years seem really stupid. It's just like it never, like, her and Picard are just, you know, thick as thieves again, running around solving problems on the ship. They spent the last 2 episodes together. There's no conflict with them. It's like they're completely over what happened in some ways. You know, Troy's back, and there was no, hey, you know, you left me. I was your best friend. I'm mad at you. It seems like this is all glossed over. So, and that's fine if you do it, but it really makes Beverly's motivation have less and less and less to stand on for what she did.
I don't necessarily agree, because, you know, and I've seen Terry's comments on this online, but they're still in crisis mode. They don't have time to reflect on who's hurt who and blah, blah, blah. They have to be focused on solving the problem at hand. So if we got time with these characters outside of this 10 episodes, and got to see them outside of this crisis, I think there would be more time to be like, hey, by the way, you really hurt me. But because right now they're in this crisis mode, they really don't have time to work with their upset feelings.
I see that.
But that could be such a good, it could have been a good narrative, though, to have that kind of underlying conflict of, you know, why have you done this, instead of just letting her off so lightly and Deanna saying, oh, I used to talk to you even though you weren't there. And it just, why make the big, it was almost a comedy kind of scene with when Worf and Deanna were reintroduced and he'd say, I've been thinking about you when I'm working on myself. And, you know, if that's harking back to the relationship that they had 20 years ago in front of her now husband, and that's okay to reflect on, why can't we reflect on what Beverly's done for 20 years?
It was more like with Beverly and Troy, it was just the super positive thing. And I love that. I did like the positive interaction and the holding hands, and it's cute. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, Riker says it in episode one, she cut us all out. She just left with no explanation. And the explanation had to do with Picard and Crusher. But I don't know. I just feel like it seems more and more selfish that, you know, what she had done. I'll reserve full judgment after seeing the whole 10 episodes. But it just feels like everything is just all hunky-dory. And, you know, all seven are around the executive conference room again, which, by the way, how good did that feel, you know?
Christos, can we introduce the topic of this week's discussion?
Oh, is that your way of saying you're going to cut all of that out, Mark?
I don't know. It depends on how long this runs.
Sure thing. All right. So today's topic is Man versus Machine Part 4. This series explores episodes throughout Star Trek where our crew goes up against a computer or artificial intelligence that is determined to destroy them. Previously covered episodes in this series include Discovery's Project Daedalus, Lower Decks Where Pleasant Fountains Lie, and Dead Stop from Enterprise. All good episodes, and you can go back and find those in our previous episodes.
No offense, but those episodes were all so much better than this one.
Well, no, I'm even talking about our discussions about those. I mean, those were, I think I was on all of those, I think. And they were, I remember them being very good discussions, so.
love all of those episodes.
I think I've said this before. Dead Stop is an Enterprise episode that I just put on sometimes. I like that episode. Mm-hmm. All right. So what is the premise and how does it relate to society in the 21st century, Kelvin?
So the Enterprise is summoned to a space station by Commodore Enright. Without explanation, Commodore Wesley, commanding the Lexington, explains in the Enterprise's transporter room, it will be a test vessel for a new revolutionary tactical computer called the M5 Multitronic Unit, designed by the brilliant Dr. Richard Daystrom. So the M5 will handle all ship functions, including responding to a simulated attack led by Wesley during the test with a crew of only 20, much to Captain Kirk's disapproval. So, what do we think?
Overall, I like this episode, first and foremost. You know, because you have to remember this came so, I mean, it's 57 years ago. So, this might have been one of the first instances where I think a television show may have explored the idea of AI running ragged. You know, it's a trope that's been used a lot, but, you know, Trek is the old school one that probably had one of the very early discussions about this way back in the day. And you have to think about, you know, it being the late 60s and how fast technology was evolving and some of the modern conveniences that we were getting and things like that. So I could see where the motivation to write this episode came. I felt Kirk's response, it goes back to Captain Kirk's chagrin, was a little heavy-handed, but otherwise, I thought the premise of the episode was very strong.
I really like this episode because I know it's very easy to talk about how particularly the original series has aged, but this subject matter is just as relevant today. I mean, what I found just crazy this week, that there was a segment on Breakfast TV here in the UK just about, you know, the modern AI androids. that kind of like have the human faces, mm-hmm. and people saying like, oh, AI is so sophisticated, it's going to take over, it's going, you know, they were going full Terminator on us. And it's exactly this. Now, clearly the M5 computer, when you look at it, you know, the computers, well, there wasn't really computers in 1967 for season two. You know, it was a big complex calculator that they were afraid was going to take over the world. But now you've got like, such sophisticated AIs and Alexa and all the other kind of devices that we take for granted, that even though the fear is still the same, it could almost happen. So I like the very basic look at what we would look back now and think, well, that's such a basic computer. We basically got an M5 computer. We've got self-driving cars. So why was Kirk so, you know, put out at the thought of here's all of these functions that the computer could have to save us a job, as opposed to it being, you know, just his ego being checked of, I'm not the one in command?
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. What surprised me about the episode was Kirk seemed almost supportive at the beginning of just like, oh, okay, I guess we're going to go along with this now. And he was sort of figuring out in his head how he landed. And there was that discussion in the corridor with Bones of like, am I crazy for feeling this way? Like, he was a little bit conflicted, but when push came to shove and the Federation is telling you need to, you know, go along with this, he was, you know, playing ball at the beginning and just like, okay, I guess this is what we're doing now. So I was caught off guard because I expected a more hard, like, no from Kirk at the beginning. And instead he was just like, well, they've told me this is what we need to do, so I'm going to support them and go along with it. And so I liked that sort of surprise. And then, you know, you see through the course of the episode that the doubt that he was struggling with, there was a reason for that. And he was smart to doubt the M5 system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I'm getting at is, you know, well, it wasn't just Kirk. There was a scene with Uhura. There was a scene with Sulu where basically they didn't have to press the button because the M5 had already done it. And they seemed quite annoyed of that the computers just decided to do this. If you get in your car now and you've got automatic windscreen wipers, you've got automatic headlamps that come on, so you don't have to remember to press. You don't get angry with the car for doing this for you. It's a smart feature. It's something that is good. So I know hindsight is a wonderful thing, but I didn't get it. I didn't understand why they were so annoyed that the computer is making their life easier, making their job easier. So I don't think it was, oh, am I just going to be completely redundant then? Was that the ultimate fear? I don't know.
Well, one of my friends, he's talked to me recently about the fact that he has a hard time now finding manual transmission for cars. Like, it's getting harder and harder to find those. And for myself, I'm just like, yeah, why would you not want automated? Like, I don't want to worry about stick shift or whatever. But there are people, and I think this is like why Sulu might have been upset. It's like, you know, that want to be in control of driving the thing more than having the computer sort of take over a lot of functions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose they did that with Tom Paris in Voyager, didn't they, when he designed the Delta Flyer to kind of, he wants to, you know, feel the ship rather than just press a button. He wants a stick shift, as you Americans would say.
Well, I think that just becomes it's just a matter of economics with the stick shift thing. As they become less popular, less are selling, so they're making more automatic cars. And so there's just no financial motivation for car companies to make them as readily available. And there's some arguments to be made about fuel efficiencies and things like that from a stick shift to be made. But kind of getting back to the topic, I think one of the reasons I think they wrote Kirk, I thought Kirk had a pretty heavy response. Although the reason he just has to go along with it is he has no choice. He's under orders. You know, his Commodore is ordering him. It's not really up for debate. He has his like doubt, his spidey senses tingling or something. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, otherwise that's just his own intuition maybe, or his own whatever. I mean, I think it's really kind of grown up that he does question himself and asks himself, am I the problem kind of thing? Is this just my problem? I thought that was very evolved, especially for the time. But I think one of the reasons it was written so strong was, if you think about it, we've been wrestling with this question now for 50, 60, 70 years. You know, in the 60s, this was kind of new territory. You know, automation, losing jobs, and, you know, what that was going to do to society. And, I mean, if you look at probably how many factory jobs have been lost to automation over the last 70 years, you know, it was probably something people were really afraid of then. And honestly, it's still a thing now. To your point, I think that's why this episode still kind of seems relevant, is that we're still talking about this, and everything is still pretty relevant for the most part. Yeah.
I know that, you know, even here around the network, there's been a lot of use in the last, you know, few months with automated systems, right? Like, people are using ChatGPT and incorporating script elements into the podcasts. I myself have used Lensa app to help create some of the artwork. Now, the way I look at it, on my perspective, and I will die on that hill, is I feel like, as far as art, I don't think that AI will ever replace, like, true art. There has to be, I feel like, a human to be able to generate, like, art that it makes you feel a certain way or whatnot. But I do feel like it can be used to enhance things or get a certain look that might be you don't have time for. Like myself, I like doing different styles of artwork for each episode, but I don't necessarily have time always to hand draw everything. And I don't just want to use the photos that are stock photos, you know, that I find online from the episode. So if I want a particular look, if I put it through the filter of Lensa, then all of a sudden it's like, hey, I can have a painting done of this particular scene, and this is the art that I would like for the episode. And I didn't have to spend the entire week doing it because Lensa just did it. Now, it was my idea, my concept, and I picked the scene, but Lensa did the hard work of, like, animating it to
me. I mean, it's a tool in your toolbox, the same way Photoshop is a tool in your toolbox, the same way it's a program. Yeah. So if it's allowing you to do stuff that you normally wouldn't have, as you would say, the time to do and whatnot, but it helps you put out a polished product, that's pretty cool. I think the bait with this type of work is, you know, will it begin to replace true artists and make the ability for a true artist to make a living, is it going to encroach on that? And I think, unfortunately, the answer is yes. You will still have the need for some in here and there, but I can tell you, living in the world of marketing, some of these tools are making things just move faster and better and cheaper and easier, and I'm hiring less people. I'm actually bringing on more software sometimes and hiring less people.
Absolutely.
And I suppose some of the fears are that when we create a tool out of convenience, or to speed up a process, or to make a process more lean and cost effective, does it actually result in de-skilling of the human? So, you know, Mark, you just mentioned in the world of art, you know, do you feel that because you've got something now that you can use that speeds time up and gives a really good product, do you feel that you are losing a skill to create that manually if you didn't have it? So, you know, and you could say in the world of cooking as well, with all the, like, kitchen conveniences that we've got, are chefs becoming de-skilled?
Yeah.
In schools, are children more dumb because they're getting all their essays done through AI?
Skills, you know, atrophy. So, I mean, have you tried to write in cursive lately? It's so much harder for me to make it look nice because I don't do it every day anymore by means. I type notes a lot more. We're typing more. They don't even teach penmanship and cursive in school now to kids because it's not as necessary. It's moved on.
There was a lot of that during the pandemic. Like, when in the UK, loads of people were furloughed and the government paid all of your wages, it was great. But then when they went back to the workplace, everyone was saying, I can't remember how to do my job. I've had, like, 4 months off work. Even driving a car from A to B they felt quite nervous on the motorway, because they'd lost a lot of confidence because they'd obviously been locked down. So yeah, there is skills atrophy is a real thing. And yeah, I think it's really interesting that it's explored through man versus machine. I'm reminded of the Undiscovered Country, Kim Cattrall line about the tossing the wooden sabots into the machines that take away our jobs, hence the word sabotage. Mm. So yeah, it's obviously been around for hundreds of years, this fear of automation.
Very true.
Right, are we going to have a look at the man himself then? Professor Richard Daystrom.
Yeah, what an interesting character. And this is one of those strings. Now, I think we discussed it on a previous episode, but I know that Gene Roddenberry didn't specifically want there to be a lot of correlation between TOS and the 90s Trek shows. He wanted to sort of leave that in the 60s. That's why you didn't see a lot of the same aliens and stuff like that. That was sort of his directive. But here is a name or a character that has literally been brought up through, I think, every iteration of Trek. And this is the first appearance of Richard Daystrom. So that was that was really cool to see.
Yeah, and for someone like me who has had to make an effort to go back and watch the original series, having grown up on TNG, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, were you here, basically anything to do with cybernetics, Daystrom, to actually go back and see the character, it's fascinating. I like the actor. The actor's voice, I could hear, I could listen to him speak all day. He's got like a very Darth Vader tone to his voice, very James Earl Jones.
Very Avery Brooks, too, just very distinct, know, very good orator. You know, that's when people have those voices, like Kate Mulgrew's another one, people who have those voices that just captivate you and you listen to every word they say. And it's about their diction and how they speak. And Maya Angelou is another one. I just always, like, anytime I see, at this point, a video of Maya Angelou, I was like, I'm listening, because she has this way of grabbing your attention.
But it was great casting, because for someone who's supposed to be a genius, a Nobel Prize winner, to be able to speak and deliver your lines with such gravitas actually gave a lot of weight
so
to
I
that
have
character.
A question, and I've literally just, this is even in the show notes because it hit me as we're speaking. So Daystrom is a name, the Daystrom Institute, the Daystrom Station, blah, blah, blah.
Daystrom Prize.
Yeah, and he had so many achievements. But when you think about M5, hundreds of people died as a result of his failed experiment here. Would you think that if with that sort of a legacy, that there'd be all these things? You know, his experiments killed hundreds of people just in this one instance. Because it would we have done, would that track now? I mean, if somebody experiment killed hundreds of people, would we be naming everything in the world after this person?
The Daystrom kind of title almost was attributed to his earlier kind of successes and the Nobel Prize, as we've just said. But in modern culture, if there was then something negative attributed to that person, they would almost be
renaming
of
everything,
their credibility, and he would be cancelled.
Well, this kind of goes into this other idea I had of, they talked about Kirk and McCoy had that really cool discussion, and you know, this guy, who is this guy? I mean, like, he got the Nobel Prize and whatnot at 24, and he's about twice that in age at the time of this episode, right? So the idea in the human race and in life in general, you know, once we achieve something of notoriety, especially at a younger age, you know, suddenly then the job becomes to do it bigger, do it better. What's the next thing? Even if you make a hit movie, it's like everyone's expecting that sequel to be just as good, if not better. Otherwise, it's a letdown and then you ruined it. But the trope of how many times, and you know, where this person had achieved greatness, and because the need, whether it's society or our own mind or our own ego jumping in there to say, I got to one up myself, I got to do that much better, has led to disaster because shortcuts got taken or whatever. Did Daystrom's ego ultimately cause, you know, this failure?
The hubris.
Yeah.
The sheer
effing hubris. Yeah. I just like, you know, it also just reminds me a little bit of David in Wrath of Khan taking shortcuts with Genesis and what, you know, and ultimately Genesis didn't work because shortcuts were taken.
But also as well, if you think just in general about maybe celebrities, if you like people in film stars, etc., who achieve fame very early in life, then they get very affected by that and they might develop some kind of like personality disorders or be more inclined to, you know, partake in drugs and alcohol and be some kind of, you know, car crash of a person because of all of this fame that they've had. So to apply that in a professional setting can be just as valid. And rather than this character just being, you know, the crazy mad scientist of the week, which quite frankly the 60s would have gone there because it was just fine to just label someone crazy on TV as the motivations to be a villain of the week, whereas you wouldn't do that now. You can actually explore this through the modern lens of this kind of sense of achievement was potentially some of the reasons that made him a flawed human in later life. So yeah, I think it was a wonderfully complex episode that dealt with very contemporary issues all those years ago. I think it was a great choice.
I don't want this topic to go by without bringing up this, I guess, hot discussion topic, which was the casting. In the 1960s, there was not a lot of representation of people of color. I think they were used, I guess, a lot to be, I guess, the tag-along sidekick for a white hero character, or they were used to show slavery and oppression stories, but not so much to show them having intelligence and them being the focus of a lot of, you know, story arcs. And so I think it was brave at the time, you know, this is myself projecting, of them to put a person of color to be the primary focus and to have the person, the character, be a genius. Now, is the genius flawed? Yes. Was that right? You know, that's debatable. But I do think at the end of the day, that was a good choice to show a little bit of representation in a somewhat positive light. And just to tag on to that really quickly, they also made the character Emery Erickson. Now, this is from Enterprise. The creator of the transporter also be a person of color. Do see a lot of the similar characteristics between that character and Daystrom. Okay, I'm done.
I almost had to stop and think because I was having those same thoughts. I'm like, are they related? Was there a relation thing there between the two of them? It's completely not. But going back to the casting of a person of color, I totally understand your point of view on that, Mark. I don't know without transporting myself into 1967 or 68. To know, does it do more positive because of all the reasons you said, or does it do more damage to be, although he's smart, he's flawed, and Kirk still knows better than him, and by the end of the episode, the guy's had a mental breakdown and has been proven completely wrong and basically shown to be a failure in this episode. I don't know if that is more detrimental to a person of color and the perception of that. Like, well, there's Kirk. He outsmarted that guy. You know, I could almost hear how a racist person would comment on this episode.
Yeah, but if the choice is that or not having a person of color in this role, then I think either way it's a lose-lose. So I really admire the casting. I thought it was genius.
No, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I think the only way this also makes okay in my head is, you know, we saw like Commodore Decker and Doomsday Machine be just as messed up, and, you know, and that was not a person of color, and it's kind of, you know, kind of has someone had basically goes to a psychotic break. I don't know why that kind of reminded me watching this episode today. I was taken back to that performance. I guess it's with one of those over the top 60s performances, but. What great acting. I don't know if you notice this, and maybe it's a part of a 75-inch TV and high definition and whatnot, but he's literally, the stress in some of the situations, you could literally see him sweating on his brow and it coming down the side of his head. And it's like, I don't even know how you do that other than turn the heat up in the room, right? To make people...
He acted the heck out
of it. Yeah, like that, mm-hmm. There was some things there that I noticed, even, you know, that are just like, wow, that was... How do you even make yourself sweat like that in the moment? Because it makes perfect sense that the character was.
That might just be the light bulbs on sets in the 1960s were horrendously right. inefficient at heat transfer. And it
was actually yeah, like just you said, sweating. Like I was saying, like maybe you would never have seen that on a 19-inch, potentially black and white TV back in the day. But it really, like I said, upscaled to HD and on a big screen TV, it really added more drama to the moment.
Yeah. He was also layered in a polyester multicolored jumpsuit, so that could have had something to do with it. Traps the heat.
Plus the light, like you were saying.
How great, though, that, you know, when a lot of people do look at the original Star Trek in modern technology and like, oh, look at that, you can see a mark on that. Even on the M5 computer that was attached to the captain's chair, there was like a big scratch on the side
like
of the box. Yeah,
it
did
was
you
brown
notice
poo stain.
It? And it was... It was so distracting. I was like, why has nobody in the continuity just wiped that off? So it's nice to hear that a fine detail of modern TVs is actually adding something
True.
To the story yeah. rather than taking us out like it normally does.
Especially with some of those switches.
I can't believe you noticed that too.
Yeah. And it was there for the full episode. I mean, if it had gone halfway through, I probably would have complained about the continuity of it. But it did look like a poo stain.
You guys are wrong for that.
Yeah. Can we just get back to Daystrom and the kind of the Daystrom legacy? Because I, you know, obviously we're here, we're on All Good Things, and as you've just said, Mark, the name Daystrom has gone through all of. I think it's only Enterprise that it wasn't actually in, which makes sense because it was so many years before Daystrom. But what was interesting is that Daystrom was in Discovery. Season 2 it was talked about, which was set before this episode. So the Daystrom Institute was not something that was kind of posthumously, you know, associated with Richard Daystrom after he was passed, but it was while he was still practicing and alive, you know. So I thought that was interesting timeline.
Well,
great catch.
Yeah, I mean, it was like they said, I think they referenced like 24 years, I guess, you know, rough before that he invented, you know, the software, I guess, that runs the Starship computers. Mm-hmm. So in Discovery, probably would have still been like 15 years past that. So I guess, you know, he would have had time to become like a modern day legend, like Stephen Hawking, you know, or things like that.
Yeah.
So,
does anyone have any favorite Daystrom references in all of Trek? I like kind of Leah Brahms becoming director at the Daystrom Institute in All Good Things, and in my headcanon, until we're told otherwise, that's where she is now, married to Geordi, off screen. At the Daystrom Institute. So I like that one. I also like the fact that the doctor said to donate his hollow emitter to the Daystrom Institute if he was to ever go offline. So yeah, it's literally everywhere in Star Trek. I love
it. I am a fan of the Daystrom Station in Picard because of the parallels with this episode where you see Daystrom Station is actually being used by Section 31 to store these black ops stuff. So it's like dangerous AI gone bad at Daystrom Station. I was like, that's kind of cool.
And that was exactly the same as Lower Decks as well. You know, that was the Daystrom cybernetics area was where they put all the crazy computers like Peanut Hamper and Agibus. So yeah, they're all locked away.
I mean, I don't really have any affinity for Daystrom. It does show up everywhere. I was going to reference what Mark was saying. It's kind of funny that Section 31 has a little office there inside Daystrom Station. I don't think it's the whole station, obviously, but that they have their own little black ops area. They're like kind of right under your nose, kind of thing, hidden in plain sight.
Well, guys, I think we should move on before we run out of time with assimilations and regenerations. As our listeners are probably aware already, assimilations are things that we like. Regenerations are things that we think should be sent back to the regeneration chamber.
You know, it's kind of a great bottle episode where the Enterprise is kind of the main character as usual, I guess. But I will say, and I watched the updated special effects version of this episode, not the original version. But we do see, the station, space station, and several other Constitution class vessels. So while it's a little bit of a bottle episode, everything is done on the sets of the Enterprise. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in a very basic gay assimilation that Commodore Wesley was really hot. I really like the guy who played him in this episode. My. I looked back, I thought, oh,
you like those little silver foxes.
I don't remember seeing him before. I do. Mm-hmm. Lovely.
When they first brought up the M5 computer, in my head, I was like, why is it called the M5 and not the M1? And then it immediately came out of Kirk's mouth. Why is it called the M5 and not the M1? So I was like, yes, thank you. Thank you for clarifying, because this would have been confusing.
Here in the UK, all of our motorways are called M with a number. Oh. So whenever I hear the M5 computer or the M1, as they say, I'm just thinking, oh, the M1, that's the route from London to Newcastle.
Oh, wow.
So, and the M5 takes you to Wales.
So
that's all I think of when I hear
that's
M5
how the freeways
computer.
Work in Hawaii too, on Oahu, and H1, H2, H3. I thought it was weird that people were questioning Spock's interest in the M5 and Daystrom. Like, why would you know about that? And what do you care about that? And it's like, well, he's a very intelligent scientist, science officer who's well educated.
Yeah.
And of course he's going to be like any professional keeping up with what's going on in his field of interest and his field of specialty. I think it just makes Spock look competent. But people want to make it sound like there's a sinister motive or something there. I don't quite understand it.
When I was watching it, I was getting some Lower Decks vibes with the episode The Stars at Night. I don't know if you guys remember that episode. But they had that ship that was completely automated, and the Cerritos was sort of racing to complete missions against
it. Oh, the Texas class.
And I was like, oh, yeah, like, this is kind of, yeah, like that. Like, they're having the Enterprise go on essentially this mission completely automated, and that was sort of the premise.
Yeah, good little parallel there. That was interesting. And then you get a lot of the classic TOS little data storage devices that they look like floppy disks, don't they? Like really brightly colored.
And they're completely
Fisher Price toys.
Yeah, that.
You can hear the plastic clunk and stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is one of those at this point in time, it takes me kind of out of it kind of thing. It's like, okay, I'm just nodding my head. They're cute. It's very colorful, but like, we've seen even compared to TNG, it's one of those things that just like make you snap out of it. And you're like, okay, wait, I got to get back in the episode.
Well, they've showed those same chips in now Discovery and Strange New Worlds. And they're like this clear sort of plastic, and they look really cool, like updated. But yeah, there it's kind of like they're wooden blocks that they've painted, and it's very obvious.
I mean,
but they're cute. I got a kick out of it. They tried in the 60s. They were trying.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if that's what we love about the episode, and we're assimilating, what are we regenerating?
Well, let's see. Well, there are two things here that one doesn't bother me as much as it most would think it would based on some of my past comments. Kirk's line, it kind of keeps coming up. There are certain things men must do to remain men, and is the computer going to replace men, and there's 430 men that are needed to run a starship. It's like, okay, that's mentioned a lot, but okay, I don't know why we keep on saying men. We could say people. We can say, this kind of shows how times change. And then we have the use of the word man, and there's also mention of God in Daystrom, how he's programmed M5 to be, have these, basically be religious, having religious principles and whatnot. And I think that just kind of smelled, I just like, why, why would anything Starfleet be doing that? So I thought that was a little bit of a sign of the time more so than it is anything.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think?
I always think it's a little bit like Kirk is quoting old poetry or something because of the, you know, the dialogue of the 60s sounds like something you'd read in an old poetry book with, you know, the man and the Lord and the this and it. Yeah, it is so old. I didn't find it offensive or uncomfortable. I just realized I was watching a classic 1960s Star Trek and that was the norm. I find it's more interesting, and also it's also quite rewarding almost to look back and see that, because actually now you can see how far we have come. So yeah, it didn't bother me.
Oh, I was gonna say, I was wondering why the Enterprise, it never made sense that the flagship for the Federation, they're like, we're gonna take this prototype computer that we haven't installed on any system before, we're gonna put it in the Enterprise, and we're gonna make the Enterprise test it out. It's like, really? Really? There's no Cerritos at that point? Like,
well, I mean, your comments make sense in today's Star Trek, but in that version of Star Trek, I mean, every ship was the same Constitution class, so what's the difference? You know what I mean? other than the notoriety of being the flagship, which I could kind of understand. But on the other hand, this is supposed to be our flagship, and we're so confident it's going to work that we want to put it in our flagship. One would say when you pilot something, you do something where there's going to be minimal risk. So I could see the see the point.
They tested loads of stuff though on the Enterprise D. I mean, even like the Traveler coming on in like episode 4 to upgrade the warp drive, and obviously that backfired.
It's for story purposes, Mark. We can't go have a whole episode over on the New Jersey.
Good
see my episode 6 Picard reference.
Yeah, very good. Pat you on the head from across the world. Well done, Christos.
Oh, I would love to see the New Jersey make an appearance, though. That would be badass.
All right, so another regeneration. Even if a ship is automated, wouldn't it need a crew in case of literally anything? It makes no sense. For example, like away missions, would we expect M5 to go make first contact with a new species? Hi, I'm the computer representing these people that are, you know, millions of light years away. You know, I'm here to say hi. I just don't think the idea of it replacing everybody for the most part makes good story sense. And maybe even in 1967 or 8, they also should have known better than to just be 100%. It could have been a little bit more written, a little bit more to make sense.
Regenerate. That's a big regenerate.
Absolutely. You guys are like, yep, I agree 100%. I got none. I can't debate that.
No arguments here.
Although saying that, when Daystrom delivered the dialogue about it being more practical to have M5 controlling where it would be too dangerous to send humans, it reminded me of a lot of the conversations in Dr. Bashir, I presume, when they were talking about holograms. You know, you don't need a doctor, so put a EMH on a space station or somewhere where living quarters are at a premium. So I like the little parallel of sometimes it's just not practical to have humans. But yeah, no humans at all, or no people at all, shall we just say. Yeah, that doesn't really make sense,
you
does
know,
it?
One thing I would regenerate is Daystrom himself. He has this motivation. He brings it up several times about not wanting man to die and how dangerous space is. I felt they could have written in a little bit more of a plot point if they kind of put in there, like maybe his father died on a starship or something on a mission exploring. So, I mean, I think his character was lacking certain motivation for why he was so adamant on this. And I think something like that could have given more motivation to the character to say he lost his wife, his father, his boy, could have been his husband. You know, somebody important to him died out in space doing what they do.
But isn't that exactly what they did with Emery Erickson in Enterprise? So it's all, you could almost argue, Christos, that maybe when they were writing, was it Daedalus, the episode in Enterprise, that they thought, let's make this character, this kind of flawed creator of the transporter, let's give him some really good backstory. And that's exactly, they've written that
and
by themselves.
And it was to save his son, right?
Yep. And if they had done that for Daystrom, it could have been less about ego. It would have come across less about ego and more about just somebody who's been hurt and lost somebody. There'd have been more compassion and more understanding of the character.
Makes him a bit more tragic rather than just, you know, person of the week.
Well, guys, we have a load of trivia. As is the case usually with the original series, there has been, you know, over 50 years of interviews and books and, you know, all kinds of stuff about TOS. So there's a lot of trivia and there's some really cool bits. So let's jump into that.
I'll kick off then. So mathematician Lawrence N. Wolfe wrote the original story for this episode, which was based on his fascination with computers. However, it emphasized that the M5 unit and its creator, Dr. Daystrom, and barely featured the Enterprise crew. It was heavily rewritten by DC Fontana, who focused the storyline around Kirk's fear of being replaced by a machine.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Like to see the original.
Yeah, that's at the end of the day, when you're making a TV show, you got to kind of make it about the people you've hired to be on it. jumping right back with that, the episode was a social commentary on American job losses caused by the increased mechanization during the 1960s.
Which is coming back up. We can relate to that now.
I don't think it's ever gone away, that.
Producer John Meredith Lucas bought Wolf's unsolicited teleplay because it could be made fast and cheap using only the existing Enterprise sets, and decided to direct the episode himself. So, I like bottle episodes that focus sort of on the crew and the ship as a character. I've always liked like those episodes. So, for me, this is a plus.
We've got the evocative music by George Dunning, composed for Metamorphosis, which was an early episode, was reused when Kirk romanticizes about sailing on his tall ship. I love that line. I'm sure that line, "All I need is a tall ship and a star to steer her by," I'm sure that became on one of the dedication plaques for
Defiant.
One of the starships.
Are you reading the next one?
And
literally the next one. That's a
no. I hadn't even read
good.
That.
That's wow. good.
There you go.
Do you want to continue with the next trivia? Just read the next one too.
No, I want to, because I had something I was going to pile on with this that I wanted to say earlier. So, pursuant to what? Oh, I love this because it just shows we're all thinking the same way. Kirk recites the poem "Sea Fever." He recites it again in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Quark paraphrases it in Little Green Men, and it appears on the USS Defiance dedication plaque. And I think this also goes back, you know, we're talking about poetry and whatnot showing up a lot of times in 60s Star Trek and whatnot. I think you also have to remember in the 1960s, it was a different time. People were so much more well-read in the classics of literature and whatnot. We didn't lose hours and hours a day playing video games, being on our phones, watching countless, you know, there was only three channels on TV. There was more time for reading. Life was a lot slower in some ways. And because people were more well-read on the classics, you did see a lot more quotations and pulling from literature in movies and TV.
Love that. Absolutely love that. This is I love this. This is the fourth time Kirk talks a computer to death. He used the skill in The Changeling, The Return of the Archons, and I, Mud. What a hilarious way to defeat a machine. And I want to tack on to that, too. If you remember Emperor Philippa Georgiou, she was being interrogated by those holograms in the future.
Yeah.
And she just starts blinking at them and makes them blink out. And I love that. So it made me think of that, too.
Fantastic. Blinking a hologram to death. What a way to go. So the remastered version replaced the stock footage in this episode, and the space station, now named Starbase 6, used images of Deep Space Station K7 from the Trouble with Tribbles in the original broadcast. Whereas in this remastered version, it was remodeled to look like Starbase 47, as seen in the Star Trek Vanguard series of models. Which, if I can just add to that to kind of paint a picture, it looks like a much more scaled back, less detailed version of the traditional Starbase that we know. So like an unrendered Starbase, like just very plain, but the basics, same basic shape. I really appreciated that when I was watching this episode, because that's what it, that's how they're transmitted through Netflix, through the streaming.
Very cool. In an early draft of TNG's Booby Trap, the character which became Leah Brahms was instead to have the surname Daystrom, and she was to be Dr. Daystrom's great-great-granddaughter. The TNG casting department didn't realize that this would call for a black actress to play the role until after Susan Gibney had been cast for the part. Although the character was thereafter renamed at the suggestion of script coordinator Eric Stillwell, a Daystrom link was retained by referring to her as having graduated from the Daystrom Institute. I see that happening in 1990 or 91, probably when that episode got made, you know, with mixed families and whatnot. Now it could be totally possible for her to still be related and appear lighter in skin tone.
Yeah, couldn't she have just married into the family and taken the name? You know... That's well, I think I would
well
preferred.
To be a great granddaughter, there'd be a relation, not just you know, her husband, what you know, but still, I don't know.
I thought it would have been a cool tie in. Yeah. This next bit of trivia was a fun find of mine that was not necessarily on Memory Alpha in the trivia, but this was I did a little digging. And William Marshall, who played Daystrom, was the cousin of Paul Winfield, who appeared in Star Trek The Wrath of Khan and TNG's Darmok. And of course, he was the primary, like, I guess, I don't, was his name Darmok? No, he was somebody else. Whatever
lead,
that character
lead alien.
Was. The lead alien one that was on the planet with Picard.
It was Captain Dathon.
Oh.
Captain Dathon and Captain Terrell, obviously, from Wrath of Khan.
Cool. Show off.
Yeah. Who needs Memory Alpha when you've got Memory Kelvin?
Yeah.
Even hungover Memory Kelvin still is, can still participate.
Don't out me. Yeah, the brain cells are not overly firing today. Sorry.
You're doing just fine. I think that was my point. Well,
final thoughts, gentlemen?
I thought it was a good episode. You know, yes, obviously... 60 years later, there are some things that just don't add up. But overall, the main story, the main plot, it's still so relevant to today that, you know, I'm not taking my normal baseball bat saying, oh, man, I can't even watch this episode. This is definitely one that's still relevant, enjoyable. Yeah, there's some things I would zhuzh if I were doing it now or even doing it then, but... For the most part, I think it makes its point and it's relevant.
Yeah, me too. I kind of want to echo not really anything different there. I think it was a hugely relevant, well-aged story that I really enjoyed going back to rewatching. I like anything that ties the different series together. So, you know, we're all sick of tweeting with the hashtag Star Trek Legacy. This was a real legacy moment that we've got Dr. Daystrom that appeared in all of the other series. So there's your legacy for the week. I think, yeah, poo-stained computers and all, it was a really good episode.
So classy.
Well, I have to say, I do watch TOS a lot. I put it on before I go to bed, so it's pretty much on most nights at my house. Not because I particularly love it, but because I can honestly fall asleep to it, and I don't need to be paying that much attention. It's just like, it's just on, it's TOS, you know, I'm not necessarily going to get invested to stay up and watch it. I could fall asleep watching it, it's fine. So I've seen a lot of these episodes, and what surprised me about this one is here is an episode that had me kind of at the edge of my seat, and that does not happen very often with TOS. So I watched this episode with some stakes, and I was really engrossed in, oh, how are they going to solve this one? Oh my goodness, like it's taken over the ship. What's going to happen? Oh my God, that person got killed. Like there was a lot happening in this episode that kept me interested, and had I put this on before bed, I probably would have stayed up and actually finished watching it.
Nice. All right. So shall we talk about our next week episode, which is going to be one that I don't have to go rewatch, although I probably will for shits and giggles. It is part two of our Captain's Chair series, which if you remember, listeners, this is host choice. And I think Captain's Chair part one was me, and I chose TNG, The Chase. Sticking with TNG, Amy's choice is going to be TNG's Unification Parts 1 and 2. And I think this is a really good reason for me to get out that special Blu-ray that I have that has Unification 1 and 2 cut as a movie and maybe watch it that way.
Nice.
But I...
Now he's showing off.
I love it. I'm actually, if anything, I'm telling listeners, if you can still find that, I think they're still available on Amazon. I know physical media is going out the door, but it's those recut movies of TNG Blu-rays are treasured possessions of mine.
My text to Amy when she messaged me that this was her choice was like, "Of course you picked a two-parter." I'm like, more work.
Greedy.
Not even really in part one, so we got to get the two-parter.
Amy's choice sounds like a book.
Oh Lord.
Back to more female problems.
Well, moving on. We would love to hear what you thought of today's episode and hope you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue the discussion there. You can also tweet your thoughts at AllGoodPod. And please follow the network on Twitter and Instagram at BQN Podcasts. We've also partnered with our friends at the Fandom Podcast Network. You can find us by searching their master feed. So, Christos, where can people find you when you are not trying to dismantle an evil AI and prevent it from killing more people?
Oh, well, people can find me on the BQN Collective on Facebook, on Twitter and Instagram at Greek Geek SD, or over on my other podcast called What's the Tea, Bev? So, Kelvin, where can people find you when you're not hanging out alone in a Jeffrey's tube with Spock?
One is never alone when you're with Spock. When I'm not doing that, you can find me here on the network in the BQN Collective Facebook group or on Twitter and or Instagram at Kelvin's Timeline. So, Mark, where can people find you when you're not rubbing off poo stains on a computer?
Oh, Lord, it would be my job, wouldn't it? Get out the baby wipes.
Someone's got to do it.
It's a lower decks job.
I kept watching that chair, and I'm like, somebody's going to clean it off. Maybe this cut, maybe that cut. But every time I looked at the screen, I was like, it was still there. Well, when I'm not doing that, people can find me, obviously, in the BQN Collective Facebook page. They can find me on Twitter at MarkWhite207. Or if they become a patron of the network on Patreon, they can listen to my show, It's Green. And we have a new episode dropping soon where Amy and I will be jumping into the DeLorean, going back to the 1980s and discussing all things 1980s and Madonna. And it was really fun. Discussion, and we were also getting buzzed at the same time. So if you want to hear slightly buzzed Amy, tune into this It's Green that's coming up soon. It's going to be fun.
We know slightly buzzed Amy very well. She's a lot of fun.
Well, please hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a star rating and written review. It helps others to find the show. You can also follow the entire network's podcast with our master feed by searching BQN. This way you won't miss any of our fine shows like Union Federation, Galaxy Class, History with the Zalagis, Infinite Diversity, Sasquatch, What's the Tea, Bev, Trekspert's Quiz, and the new Captain's Couch, which if you haven't listened yet is great. Captain Jeremiah goes through and discusses all topics related to his favorite show, Star Trek Voyager. So worth checking out.
I really enjoyed the first episode. I heard it the other day. I love the premise of the first episode being like, why Voyager? So if you weren't a fan already, it makes you want to be a fan. But I didn't need any prodding. At this time, we'd like to thank our associate producers, Mahedran Radhakrishnan and Tim Cooper. A special thanks to Graham Kelly for our opening and closing music, and to our very own Mark White for our artwork each and every week.
If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. We'll add you to the Hive Mind Facebook group so you can enjoy shows like It's Green, Amy's Math Moments, and other network perks. With a monthly subscription of $5 or more, you can join our meetings on the Hive Mind Roundtable discussion on the second Saturday of every month. Visit patreon.com/BQN to get all the details and watch your messages.
Thank you for listening.
We hope you'll join us as we search out
all good things.
Oh, Calvin, you do it the same way every time. You're just like, all good things. So cheery.
I like to be predictable.